The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org. Good evening. Welcome, welcome. So I'd like to give a little talk about how practice meets life, meets our life. I gave a version of this talk at a retreat I just finished, so apologies to anybody who has already heard this before, or a version of this before. But I'd like to start by saying there's a way in which we can practice with a real wish to follow the directions precisely and make sure that we understand every single word and that we know exactly what's being pointed to, and with a real direction and intentionality and a kind of a specificity, a real specificity about, okay, this is what the instructions are, this is what I'm going to do. And if I'm not clear about any part, I'll go fine, get some clarification. But this often can have a certain amount of striving to it, with a sense of, okay, if I understand everything and practice in accordance with this, then something fantastic will happen. This is a great way to practice. It's a fantastic way to practice. But there's also another way to practice that is also a great way to practice and a fantastic way to practice in a way that can really support the unfolding of our life, the unfolding of our Dharma practice in a way that is just as fruitful or benefit, filled with benefit or beautiful. And maybe before I talk about that, I'll say that I'm actually quite inspired by and motivated by or guided by this something that the Buddha said right before his awakening. And he described his mind, and he used this word malleable. So it's flexible, can be go this way or that way. Is I think of malleable as the opposite of brittle, opposite of really stuck, and that things having to be one particular way, but instead with a feeling of what's bendable, can accommodate whatever is needed to be accommodated at that time. Instead of a real grabbing onto and sticking to, the instructions are exactly this, I have to follow them. So another way is, rather than having this kind of precision in maybe the mind, the way that it's thinking about practice, is a way that can be a little bit more diffuse. Maybe I'll use this word, or softer, a way in which we're sensing our way, our feeling our way, maybe a little bit more of an intuitive sense. You can interpret intuitive in a number of different ways, but I would say more of a recognizing that, okay, feeling like freedom is more, there's more freedom this direction, but not that direction, and being tuned into that. And of course, this other way of being a little bit more feeling our way in is requires a certain amount of not only some tuning in to ourselves, what our experience is, but also trusting ourselves and trusting that even if we do find ourselves going a way that has less freedom, that we can find our way back or find our way over or find our way forward. Or maybe just find our way right exactly there, where there's a little more freedom and ease. So these are two different ways of practicing. Fantastic, both of them. And we can see even that the Buddha even taught both of these ways. In the suttas, for example, we see these lists, lots of lists of things, right, that have a certain amount of precision and, you know, first this and then that, you know, a list of five things, and they're always in the same order. As well as the meditation instructions, for those of you who are familiar with Satipatthana, has, you know, lists and the specific directions, or Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing, or Satipatthana are like some of the establishments of mindfulness. So we definitely see this kind of encouragement, perhaps, for some precision and directionality and directions. But we also find in the suttas a lot of verse, that is, things that are less specific, perhaps, but are just maybe using a different way of expressing and maybe a little bit more feeling into and maybe indirectly pointing to. In the same way, we find a lot of similes and metaphors. So a way in which we can, I don't know, I'm using this word sensing or feeling our way in. So just a recognition that there's different ways to practice and that it can be tremendously valuable to be malleable with this, to use both ways, to use a way that maybe that works until it doesn't work, and then you can maybe try something else, follow the instructions, but when the instructions, you don't have access to them or they don't make sense, then maybe what is the intuitive way? Or maybe you're following your sensing or feeling your way in and you feel like you're stuck and you're not sure where to go, then what are the instructions? So just an encouragement to explore and play with this. And then to build on this idea of different ways of approaching practice or being with practice is to point to the way in which poetry, as opposed to prose. Poetry is often a different way in which things might get expressed, or we might express things ourselves. But part of poetry, the beauty of poetry, is that it requires that the person who's writing the poem have some real clarity, have some acuity, have some real connection with what it is they're trying to express, so that then it can be expressed in a compact way or expressed with metaphor, so that then maybe the person who hears or reads the poem can find their way, can feel their way into what the person who wrote the poem was using with some real precision, they're experiencing with some precision. So I'd like to read this poem and talk about it a little bit. It's written by Jane Hirschfield. She is a poet, and she's also a Zen practitioner, and she practiced at the San Francisco Zen Center, and I believe she lived at Tassajara for a while. She also translates from Japanese and writes essays. And it's a short poem that she wrote that's very beautiful, in my view. I think it's really beautiful. Maybe I'll have a little drink of water first here. So the poem goes: "It is foolish to let a young redwood grow next to a house. Even in this one lifetime, you will have to choose. That great calm being, this clutter of soup pots and books. Already, the first branch tips brush at the window. Softly, calmly, immensity taps at your life. So for the Buddha, in ancient India, the Bodhi tree was a magnificent, majestic, maybe it had some sacredness to it in the way that they are, the Bodhi trees. But for Jane Hirschfield and those of us living in California, the redwood tree has this tremendous, in my view, majesty, dignity. It's quite something. For those of you who have been in redwood groves, you know that there's often can be just a sense of awe, a sense of like being in a cathedral. Some of you know that redwood trees, that how they propagate is that young trees, the saplings grow a certain distance from the parent tree. So what happens over the years is all the youngsters, the children trees, if you will, are in a concentric circle around the parent. And then over time, if the parent dies, and then you're left with these rings of redwood trees that can be incredible to stand inside. It has the feeling of being in a cathedral. So in this poem, we might understand that trees, redwood trees in particular, represents practice, represents something that's awe, some more sacred or majestic, or kind of has a certain amount of dignity and uprightness to them. And then the house, we can understand for the Buddha, the house was represented attachments, things that we fill our life with, and the things that we grab onto and cling to and are grasping to. So things that we are getting tangled up with. And you might recall that in the story of the Buddha, he left the household life with this was literal, but it can also be symbolic of to leave behind those things that we busy ourselves with and get that we use to support a sense of self, promote a sense of self, protect a sense of self that we really are like identified with, and in a way in which there isn't freedom, in a way in which there isn't ease, but that we're there, these things that are sticky and maybe that we're, I like this word, tangled up with. So Jane Hirschfield writes, it's foolish to plant a young redwood next to a tree. The Buddha, he used this word foolish to, he called people foolish. Sometimes we hear this, you foolish person. But he was saying this to those people who didn't recognize that what they were doing was a source of suffering for themselves and presumably for others as well. To be foolish, in the Buddha's words, is to not recognize that what you think is going to be a source of happiness is actually a source of suffering. And to become sensitive to that, with an encouragement to understand the difference between what are sources of lasting or a certain amount of happiness that's not just pleasure, and as opposed to what leads to suffering. So then Jane Hirschfield writes, even in this one lifetime, you will have to choose. For those who have been here to the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, right, there's plenty of redwood trees here, that there's a redwood tree that's out in front of the building here. It's probably 8 feet in diameter. It's a big tree. Can you imagine what would have happened, right? Literally, if this tree were planted right next to this building and the tree just grew and grew, right? There would be big problems with this this used to be a church before it was a meditation center. Of course, those of you who have been here to IMC, you might have noticed that the sidewalk that goes next to where the tree is a number of years ago started to buckle because of the roots from this tree. You know, the tree is just standing there, but yet it has this strength, it has this power to cause the sidewalk to have to shift. And we were concerned that, you know, somebody might trip over this sidewalk. So we called the city of Redwood City, and they brought their municipal department out. And in my mind, I thought, oh, that maybe they might shave off some of the roots. And of course, leaving the rest of the roots so the tree could survive, and then just put a new sidewalk down. But no, they were pretty savvy to the way of redwood trees, and they rerouted the sidewalk around this tree, maybe 4 feet. They moved it around this tree. I felt quite touched by that, actually, that they kind of wanted to honor and respect that, okay, here's this tree. This whole municipal works, and all these individuals, we're just going to walk around this tree. Just recognizing the power, the strength of this being that is just standing there in a calm way. Practice that might just be there in a calm way. And yet there might be some movement underneath that we can't see, with the roots that starts to shake things up and starts to cause things to shift and to dismantle. So Jane Hirschfield writes, even in this one time you will have to choose that great calm being, this clutter of soup pots and books. Our practice, our meditation practice, our insights, our growing wisdom, our growing compassion is going to touch into all of our life. Jane, maybe it's a little bit autobiographical, she's talking about this clutter of soup pots and books. I'm assuming she's a poet and a translator and an essayist, that she probably has a lot of books, and maybe she likes to cook. But also this idea of a clutter of things. Our things clutter are often things that are like dismissed. They're not taken care of. We don't pay attention to them. They are a little bit unruly in a way that can be bothersome. Often that we just don't pay attention to clutter. That's why it's clutter. So you'll have to choose between that great calm being and this clutter of soup pots and books. So just as it is the nature of trees to grow, is what trees do, of course. It's the nature of practice to grow. And it starts to expand and touch into those things that we are attached to. So it's not the soup pots per se, it's not the books per se, it's not the clutter per se that we're being asked to dismantle, it's the clinging, it's the grasping, it's the belief that these are going to be sources of lasting happiness, that it's the hiding behind the objects that we fill our lives with. It's the trying to bolster a sense of how we think we should be instead of how we actually are. So practice does two things. It helps us to see more clearly these things that we cling to, grasp, that we're attached to, things that have some stickiness for us. So practice helps us to see, either see clearly or maybe we feel it. Maybe we feel the contraction that goes with clinging and grasping. But practice also helps us to gain the confidence or the wherewithal in which we can diminish or let go or stop or cease the clinging, the grasping, the attachments. So it's not asking us to let go of the soup pots and books, but to shift our relationship to these things in our lives. So if you want to stay really attached and really want to stay grasping and clinging to all the things that are in your life, whether they are helpful or not, but to really want to hold on to them, then don't practice. It's foolish to plant a young redwood next to a house. And then maybe I'll say that the Buddha recognized that the house could also be a metaphor for a self. That is, the way that we think that we should be, the way that we want to project to the world, or the ideas that we have about ourselves, or any ideas that we have about a constant, enduring self, without recognizing that there isn't an inherent, constant self. And the Buddha, reported or attributed to the Buddha soon after his awakening, has this verse, another little poem. This is in the Dhammapada, a collection of verses. So the Buddha says, "House builder, you are seen. You will not build a house again. All the rafters are broken, the ridgepole destroyed. The mind, gone to the unconstructed, has reached the end of craving." House builder, you are seen. You will not build a house again. The rafters are broken, the ridgepole destroyed. The mind, gone to the unconstructed, has reached the end of craving. So this poem has seems a little bit violent in some way, that things are broken and destroyed. It doesn't have to be that way, but way that we can just gently dismantle, just gently deconstruct some of the houses, so to speak, that we've constructed. We can let go, soften the ways in which we cling or hold on to. I know for me, I noticed that some resentments or grudges that I might have had, they just stop making sense to hold on to them. So things that we carry from the past, or maybe they're happening here in the present, but the way that they kind of reinforce a sense of self, as opposed to a sense of recognizing of what's here and the way that we are constructing, that we want to be seen a particular way. But if we can soften that, then some of the grudges can go away, or the resentments. So Jane Hirschfield continues in this poem, "Already the first branch tips brush at the window." She's pointing to the branch tips that are what are above the ground, but maybe by the time the branch tips have gotten to the tree, chances are the roots have all... I'm sorry, by the time the branch tips have already gotten to the window, the roots have already gotten underneath the house, and maybe they're in the sewage system or wrecking some type of havoc or in that way. But this way in which the branch tips meet the window is a way in which practice meets our life. It's one way we can understand it. And it's not always pleasant. I want to also bring to mind, you know, there's these stories with the Buddha that before his awakening, while he still had a house, so to speak, that he met Mara. Mara is the personification, or maybe we could say the aspect of the heart and the mind that creates roadblocks or gives excuses or procrastinates, or that aspect of the mind that urges us to avoid all the unpleasant mind states or any of the uncomfortableness that we might experience in our practice, but that always accompany the healing that happens, or always accompany when practice is moving into more and more areas of our life. There are some aspects that are uncomfortable. So this meeting, maybe the branch tips against the window or making an uncomfortable sound or some way. It's a recognition that it's not always simple, it's not always easy, it's not always pleasant. But by committing to practice and by committing to having the heart's liberation and greater freedom, also means that we're committing to meeting these things, meeting what might be uncomfortable or difficult. And the Buddha, you know, even after his awakening, many of you know that the Mara came and still visited the Buddha. And then the Buddha would meet him with loving awareness, with wisdom, and would simply say, "I see you, Mara." And then Mara would skulk away. So in this way, we might reflect on the ways in which practice has shown up in our lives. And then the last line of the poem, "Softly, calmly, immensity taps at your life." Immensity, this vastness, this boundlessness, limitlessness, tapping at your life, which maybe is a little bit stronger than brush tips against the window, is this something, an invitation, a recognition that we don't have to limit ourselves. We don't have to create strict definitions in which the way that we define ourselves or define our experience. And with that, as practice progresses, we might also understand that then maybe there's a shift. In this poem she writes, "This calm being, that clutter of soup pots and books." Maybe with practice the emphasis shifts. "This calm being, my experience, and that clutter," becomes more clear. We can feel our way into somehow, some way, into where there's more freedom and less freedom. It is foolish to let a young redwood grow next to a house. Even in this one lifetime, you will have to choose. That great calm being, this clutter of soup pots and books. Already the first branch tips brush at the window. Softly, calmly, immensity taps at your life. Thank you.